Welcome to the Hacking Happy podcast. My name is Penny Lacaso, and I'm the world's first happiness hacker on a bold mission to teach 10 million women how to flourish on their terms by 2025. The Hacking Happy podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. I'd like to pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This podcast is designed to help you reignite your spark, supercharge your energy, and channel more of it towards injecting more joy, more presence, more calm, and more meaning into each day. If that sounds like something you could use a little more of, let's get started. Hello, beautiful happiness hackers, and welcome to another episode of the Hacking Happy podcast. Today, I am joined by a very special guest. Her name is Dr. Sarah McKay. Sarah, welcome.
Hi.
There's a bit of a backstory to your being here, which is a bit unusual for the podcast, which I want to share because I just think it makes the world feel so small. And that was that about a month ago, I was on one of my triad peer therapy sessions for the training that I'm doing with Dr. Gabor Maté on compassionate inquiry, which is all around trauma. And one of the beautiful women in that group who's based in Romania, we were talking about being mothers and the challenges and how motherhood fundamentally changes us. And she said, oh, there's this amazing doctor out of Australia, and she's a neuroscientist and she's done all of this work in this domain. She's published books, and the books as the mother of a young child, she said, had changed her life. And I'm like, how do I not know about this woman? So of course it was 10 o'clock at night by the time I finished the session. I jumped on LinkedIn and lo and behold, you and I were connected. And I reached out and said, can you come on the podcast? And you said, hell yes.
Yeah, it's a small world. I've said before, I've got a lot of my students are in Romania, which is always nice. I have this amazing kind of global studentship, and I don't think I would teach a course without two or three Romanians popping up, which is always super interesting.
Well, it's interesting as well because there's a lot of them that do Gabor's training on trauma. Like, he's got a massive following out of Romania. So clearly there is some propensity for Romanians to be very invested in their growth and development, or, you know, understanding of themselves, which is an insight in and of itself. But I'm going to start where we always start, Sarah, with this podcast. Before I do, actually, I just want to say the reason I'm so curious about your work is I have so many women that I work with that come to me because they've had children, and having children, they say to me, it's changed me. It's changed what gives me meaning in life, and it's changed how I actually want to show up, and equally often the type of work that I want to do. So often when they come to me, they're either looking to make a significant change in terms of their career, or they're looking to start their own business because of that shift within them. So that's where I want to go with you today. But before we do, tell us who you are as a human being.
Oh gosh, I always find that a very large question to answer. I don't think too deeply about these things, to be honest. So I you know, I'm more of a like top line resume kind of deliverer of content. I'm a neuroscientist. I'm a mum of two teenage boys. I have a very long and happy marriage. I've been with my husband. We met over 25 years ago now. I've got a new puppy lying on the floor next to me, flat in his back, spread-eagled, flat in his back. I grew up in New Zealand, spent 6 years living in the UK, and I've been in Australia on Sydney's northern beaches for more than half my life now.
So before we get into how you landed where you are, I'm really curious, as a child, as a young girl, what did you want to be and why?
I don't think I ever, I mean, I chopped and changed around a lot of different ideas, particularly when I was much younger. I was always a reader. I always had a book in my hand. I remember after school on Fridays, I would go to our local library. I'd bike to my local library and bring home like a giant stack of books. I remember I used to try and put them in a bag and my bike carrier, and they'd always be flopping off. I just like loved just bringing home this big stack of books to read. I was an avid reader, but didn't really have a very clear career perspective, because I grew up in a very ordinary working class home in Christchurch, New Zealand, surrounded by lots of people living at the same kind of lives. Our lives weren't very big. They were very calm and warm and full of love. And it was a very golden childhood. And my memories of it are great. You know, I'd never met anyone who even went to university before, except my GP and my dentist. So I really had no kind of concept of a career as such. I didn't, you know, the only kind of ideas I had that you could grow up to be were, well, my dad was an electrician and mum was at home. I had lots of family who were nurses, but I never really kind of thought, so I never really kind of, a career wasn't a thing that I had in mind. And that's fine. I just kind of carried on through school and I loved school. I was really good at school. I enjoyed learning and I was good at learning and I was good at most things I did. I loved art and I was very good at art and I loved English and I was good at English and I loved science. The only subject I didn't love was maths, but I worked hard enough at that to do well. So really for me, it was just like a love. It was a love of learning. And I remember went off to university and was doing a sort of a first year sort of general health sciences degree because I thought, oh, well, I'll go into, you know, and that kind of set you up. You could go into medicine or dentistry or physio or pharmacy or any of that, those kinds of health sciences. But I was doing it in my hometown. And I remember my best friend, Carol, was still really close now. She's now a psychiatrist. We went around to a friend's house who was a year ahead of us at university. God, remember, we went around and we were like asking him, like, when you're sitting in a lecture, how do you know what to write down? And we were like, we really loved learning and wanted to learn well, but we just had no concept of the world outside this kind of little bubble that we'd grown up in. And sometimes we look back now and go, oh, yeah, we did it right. You know, her dad was also an electrician. We're like, you know what, we did okay, didn't we? I'm not of the belief that you necessarily need these, you need to become what you see or whatever. I mean, it was really, we just liked learning stuff and just put our heads down and whatever was kind of in front of us happened next.
I love that. And that's kind of the method in my madness of asking that question, because so many women that come to me think that there's like a right path. And I think when we're raised, you know, it's like you need to know what you're going to do and you follow the path and that's how your life evolves. But I always say there is no right path. There could be a million right paths and equally the action, like what you've just spoken to, it's the action that breeds the clarity. So your love of learning and leaning into that is obviously what landed you into neuroscience.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny because we were never, you know, I went to an all-girls Catholic school and we were never taught that we couldn't be anything. And there wasn't even really girl, we just carried on. We didn't think about things like sex and gender and anything. Then we literally just, what was in front of us happened next. And maybe everyone's life was like that in the 90s. We were having a good time. We were studying hard and that was the extent of the depth of our thoughts about what was next in life and where were we going and what were we meant to be doing. And I actually did really badly in my end of year high school exams, the equivalent of HSC here in Australia. I failed a couple of them after being like head of the school and type A overachiever and always getting A pluses. So it was a bit of a shock for various reasons that happened, burnout and stupid subject choices and bad kind of advice. And then similarly, in my first year of university, it was like, wow, this world of this sort of social life opened up for us. We always had a lot of male friends, but suddenly we were all hanging out in the same place and we were so busy going to parties that, you know, study kind of fell to the side. But that's also okay. You know, I think that's university then is not what university life is now. And for us, it was about, and I say us, is because this friend, you know, we've known each other since we were in kindergarten, we're still close now. So, you know, she's so embedded in my life. And then when I say us, I'm meaning me and her, the social world that we were part of was almost more important than the content that we were learning in lectures.
So how did you discover this passion for neuroscience?
That happened in that same year, in my first year of university. I'd kind of failed a couple of subjects. I'd failed that I'd done really well in an HSC and I'd failed at uni. But I was doing psychology 101, like, I mean, I think half the university population back then did psych 101. And we were in the biology of psychology sort of block of lectures and labs. And I always really loved biology. But this is the first time I'd done kind of human biology in a way. Because 1990s high school science in New Zealand didn't teach, you know, we did a lot of plant biology and photosynthesis and stuff like that. And in that lecture, we were learning about the brain and we were learning about synapses and neurons and brain cells and how they connect up. And literally, when they were explaining the biological mechanism of how synapses worked, I was just like, my mind was blown. I literally thought it was the coolest biological mechanism I'd ever learned about. I was just captivated. And then we were also recommended, and I've got the books, people often ask me, so I always have it at hand. And then the lecturer recommended we read this book here, which is Oliver Sacks, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And Oliver Sacks is a really famous neurologist, and he writes up these amazing kind of case studies and stories about the things that go wrong with people's thoughts and feelings and behaviours when they've got issues with their brain or with their neurology. He was a neurologist. And it was just so utterly fascinating to get this insight, I suppose, into human thoughts and feelings and behaviours, but not in this kind of black box psychology perspective, but in this really kind of mechanistic biological sort of perspective. And I remember thinking, gosh, that's cool. And then another friend who was in those lectures, his name's Glenn, he ended up becoming a dentist. He said to me, hey, did you know that they're starting a neuroscience degree at Otago University? We were at Canterbury University at the time in Christchurch, and this is Otago University in Dunedin, kind of 4 hours south down the east coast of the South Island. And I thought, that sounds really interesting. So I kind of hopped in a bus and went, caught the bus down there and sort of walked around the university and knocked on various, like the head of neuroscience door, and they just literally put together this new discipline. And I just went and knocked on a few doors and said, can I have a chat about this degree? Showing there, and I have never, this whole thing about imposter syndrome hadn't been invented then. I just said, I'll just go and knock on people's doors and ask questions. Anyone now can still go and do that. I just went and did this stuff without thinking. And they were very welcoming, said, come on in, and, you know, why don't you switch universities? So the next year I moved universities, enrolled in the neuroscience program there, and then that's been it. You know, that was 1993. 31 years later, I'm still doing the same. Still just think it's just synapses are just as interesting now as they were then.
So what I loved about your profile, your bio, when I read it, was that you take meaningful research, and as someone who studies psychology, I just feel this is so important, that is obviously written in academic speak, and you translate it into insight to teach coaches, therapists, teachers, and other helping professionals how to leverage neuroscience to support their patients to be the best version of themselves. Mm-hmm. And your specialty, from what I've observed, is really in the domain of women and, you know, women through the lifespan, and equally how they shift into motherhood and how our neurobiology changes in that domain. So if we start there, mm-hmm. Let's start with mothers. What on your journey have you learned about how pregnancy and motherhood changes us for the better?
I think I've learned that it does change us for the better, and I've learned that the vast majority of any conversations that we ever have about the female lifespan and neurobiology and hormones focus solely in on deficits and dysfunction.
Yeah.
And no one's ever interested in talking about the upsides of things, as if life as a female is just a shit show to be endured. And I've never experienced that personally, but, you know, I'm unusual, or something is going on. I really became, I mean, this was never my specialty, women's health and neuroendocrinology, the kind of combination of neuroscience and hormones was never my jam, really, all the way through my neuroscience training and research, etc. I always worked on neuroplasticity and mechanisms of injury and recovery from injury. I was particularly interested in spinal cord injury. But in sort of 2016, I was approached by a publisher asking if I wanted to write a book. And I said, no, sounds like hard work. And they said, let's chat. And as we were talking about topics that I had written about that had resonated with an audience, the topic of women's health came up. Actually, initially it came up around menopause. But I thought, I don't want to write about menopause, although that's a hot topic now. Perhaps I should have written that book. I think the latest book that's out just now, it's a recent book out written by a neuroscientist. But anyway, so I, you know, we kind of came up with this idea of writing this book of looking at through the female lifespan at how the brain is shaped and changes and grows. And I firmly believe that you can't think about any point in the lifespan without looking at what has contributed to you get to that point, whether that be how your biology has shifted, your life experiences, your expectations, your current situation, all of that combines into like a nervous system read in and read out of where you are and what's happening. And so I was interested in looking at different stages through sort of puberty, pregnancy, menopause, etc. But it had to be from a lifespan perspective. While I was writing my first book, from that kind of lifespan view. And it was 2016, 17, and there was not the data that we even have now. Then there were a lot of gaps. There are a lot of like mounds of research about random things and then other gaps about topics you might think were more interesting. But in the midst of writing that book, this paper was published around early January 2017, describing how women's brains changed during the course of their first pregnancy, brain scans done before and immediately after that pregnancy, showing that there was significant structural reorganisation or rewiring of the brain, particularly in parts of the brain involved with social cognition and empathy and theory of mind. And it clearly showed that there was this enormous upside, this enormous adaptive benefit. You know, Mother Nature had a good reason for changing our brains during pregnancy to prepare us for the act of motherhood, which is not a surprise to neuroscientists who have any understanding of the maternal brain, because we know that from every other study that's been done in mammalian mothers. So the maternal brain in other animals has been very, very well studied and understood and looked at for a long time. It just hadn't been done in humans. And it really struck me because every conversation that anyone ever had outside of neuroscience was about, to do with a brain, was about baby brain, was about
baby brain. Yeah, that's immediately what came.
Yeah, so every conversation was about the downsides, baby brain, cognitive fogginess, postnatal depression. It was like you can only, if anything to do with a hormone and a brain and a female is, as I said, deficit focused. So, but that's in contrast to what we know about the neuroscience. And if we looked kind of in times before this research came out and we look at all of the other kind of studies of the mammalian mother's brain, the maternal brain, animals get better at doing what they need to do to survive and to enhance kind of the survival of their young. So if you are a predator, then the mother will become better at predation. She'll become faster and sharper and have better reflexes to pounce on her prey. And if you're the kind of an animal that kind of hunts or gathers seeds and nuts and you need to sort of scurry through a maze and find your way through a maze and find, remember where your seeds are hidden, you'll get better at that. There'll be enhancement there. And if you are a herding animal that has to recognize your little lamb from the 100 other little lambs born that day in the flock of sheep, you can remember your lamb by smell within minutes after it's born and recognize your lamb from 100 others. You'll get better at your sense of smell because that's how you identify yours in the flock of sheep. We see all of this enhancement, yet all of the stories are around deficits. It's like what to expect when you're expecting. If there's a chapter on the brain, it's around deficits and all of the downsides and how to counteract them. And I was incredibly frustrated that the neuroscience stories of the upsides weren't getting out, and we just continue to perpetuate this stereotype, which has driven me nuts for years. And I was never raised with this, mind you, that you know, hormones are just to our detriment.
How can we use this information to our advantage?
Well, you can read my books. And I mean, I honestly think if you become educated on what is actually happening, kind of what are the intentions, and then you even step back and ask yourself, well, what would Mother Nature's intention be for us to become less smart, become sort of stupid emotional wrecks? I mean, what would be the benefit of that? And when that does happen, when people have that experience of what's going on and why, you know, kind of what's lacking, what's missing from the equation that's had that as the outcome. And that's a pretty brutally factual way of looking at it. But I mean, there's nicer ways of saying that we can kind of go, woman experiencing baby brain, putting their hands up and describing these experiences that they have, what is going on and what's contributing to that, and kind of try and look at that and interrogate that in the book. And then what we do know from the data, what are the upsides, what are the benefits, what was Mother Nature's intention? And how can we enhance the upsides? It's almost like positive psychology and coaching is all about spotting your strengths, you know, not sitting around ruminating over your deficits and the things that have gone wrong, and all you end up doing is wallowing in the negative. Like, perhaps if we wallowed around in some of the upsides and the positives, we could build a bit of resilience into the system.
Hey there, let me ask you. Are you done with feeling overwhelmed and unsure of where to start when it comes to creating the freedom and flow to work and live on your terms and do it with joy in your heart? You've decided it's time to invest in a coach and fast-track the shift you've been longing to make, but it feels like you're stepping into a world of snake oil sellers. I hear you,
And you're right, finding a coach that you connect with that actually delivers on their promise can be hard. So many prospective clients tell me how they've been burned, and it makes me feel ill. It's for all of these reasons I created a simple free cheat sheet to help you find the right coach for you and get the results that you need when it comes to making this shift. Simply DM me the word coach via Instagram at hackinghappy.co and I will shoot you a copy straight away. And now back to the podcast.
For a new mother, how could she bring her attention to what the upsides are? Because I feel, I mean, we know the brain has a predisposition to focusing on the negative, which is probably why, as you say, most of the stories around having babies, et cetera, for women were around the negative hormonal changes rather than the positive ones.
Well, I mean, there's not negative hormonal changes and positive hormonal changes. There are biological fluctuations that have outcomes, which evolution has chosen for. It's probably easiest to explain what happens and then women can kind of take that away. Rather than me telling what I think women should be doing, I can explain the science and then they can figure out how to embed that into the story that they're telling themselves. So, I mean, what we understand from the brain imaging research that has come out, it shows that the brain undergoes the significant reorganization. A lot of it happens during the third trimester of pregnancy when your estrogen levels are at your highest, and it's likely, we think it's most likely to do with the type of estrogen that you experience during pregnancy, which is the dose that you receive during one pregnancy is more than the entire rest of your lifespan combined dose. So you get this enormous dose, and estrogen is a cognitive enhancer. It basically builds resilience. It protects your brain. So it's having this amazing kind of big effect during pregnancy, and that is to reorganize the maternal brain so that you become tuned in to social cues, primarily the cues of your newborn baby, which is this whole entire human which has emerged from your body, who has landed in your life and consumed your attention. And your maternal brain has essentially gone into this state of exquisite plasticity and readiness to learn, in much the same way a little baby's brain is in terms of readiness to learn language, and the same way that a teenager's brain is in terms of readiness to understand and learn emotional regulation skills, new social skills, and skills of kind of higher order executive functioning, like, you know, reasoning and judgment and problem solving. The maternal brain is in this exquisite state of neuroplasticity primed by pregnancy to learn to respond and understand a baby's cues. And first of all, those baby's cues are pretty much limited to crying and to its cuteness. You know, we just like are drawn towards them. And so kind of what happens is that your entire attention is guided strongly by your biology, is guided towards focusing almost solely on this new little human. And there's a reason for that, because you really need to be keeping this human alive.
Alive.
Your biological mandate is not to be remembering to answer the emails or remembering where you put your keys or your purse, because it's always the keys in the purse. It's not to be remembering all these sort of superfluous things that you used to do in your pre-new mother life. Your biological mandate is to focus in on the baby. But for some reason, we've carried this story in that, you know, we are these high-performing career women that continue needing to be high-performing career women whilst fighting against the biological mandate to focus solely on the baby. And what happens is memory depends on attention, and attention depends on what information we take in and what information we filter out. And when you are a new mother, there are a lot of demands on you. You know, your body's recovering. You know, everything has shifted in your body. A new being has emerged from your body. You're learning to breastfeed. If you've chosen to breastfeed, you know, you're probably having less sleep than you've ever had before in your life. Like, everything has shifted and changed around you. You're not going to pay attention to all the things that you used to be able to. And so you're going to forget some of them. That doesn't mean you're experiencing cognitive dysfunction. That doesn't mean that you have baby brain as some sort of neurological deficit. It simply means your attention is elsewhere. We can't multitask. This is the least time in which we should be thinking that we could. We don't need to be. We need to be focusing on the baby, or at least that's what evolution's mandate is, for us to be focusing on the baby, to be learning how to take care of that baby, other people gathering around us to support us and nurture us, where we learn to nurture that baby. that's what's happened in the brain to enable us to change in that way. If we go in and look at the brain imaging studies, and there's not a lot, but, you know, we're getting more and more data. I've looked, you can see the structural change, like what it looks like, looks slightly different. And it is, the volume is slightly decreased in these brains by about 4%, and people freak out and go, oh, it's degeneration, like, because as if like shrinkage can only mean one thing. That's why neuroscience is fascinating and interesting, because it's not always what you expect. Brains want to become efficient. Brains are very, very energy hungry, and they want to be as efficient as possible. So when you learn a new skill, as you're a novice in any skill, whether you're learning to play golf or a musical instrument or learning how to care for a baby, a lot of your kind of brain power or cortical real estate is kind of employed as you're learning. But as you become more skilled, you kind of streamline and refine, and the connections that aren't needed are kind of thrown off or pruned away, and the brain actually gets more efficient and almost kind of sort of meaner and leaner. And that's literally what we are seeing with pregnancy and motherhood, is we are seeing the brain, the parts of the brain involved with mother care, becoming leaner and meaner. We see the same during adolescence. We see tiny loss of volume in the gray matter as adolescents, teenagers, develop new skills. And we see that in all kinds of learning in the brain. So we're seeing this happening. The brain scans showing how the brain is functioning show the maternal brain is, get this, we've got all these hubs and kind of nodes in the brain, and they're all communicating and connecting with each other. We can get these kind of quantitative readouts of how efficient those networks are. And mothers' brains are more efficient. They are more flexible and they are more responsive, particularly to reading social cues, than non-mothers' brains. They've literally got better at doing what they do. What's going on with the baby brain then? This is really the big question, because women are putting their hands up. 4 out of 5 women. I was 1 out of 5. I didn't experience baby brain. Tellingly, I didn't even know it was a thing. I didn't expect to. When I was expecting, I wasn't expecting to experience baby brain because I'd never heard of it. And I honestly do believe that is part of it, but not the whole story, but I think it's a large part of it. These days we can talk ourselves into anxiety. You can think yourself into anxiety.
We have this conversation all the time.
You can
think yourself into
depression. You can think yourself into baby brain. There is so much information out there which is making its way into our brains from the world around us, through our senses, that gets turned into expectations. We're very happy to talk about cognitive biases. We're very happy to talk about placebo effects. There's a component of that in here, right? People don't like to hear that, but there is a component of that in here. 4 out of 5 women are saying, I've got baby brain. So we're getting them into the research lab and we're doing our cognitive battery of tests on them. Let's check how your cognition is working. No one is showing any signs of cognitive decline. We're not getting markers of early onset Alzheimer's, not needing to send you off to the memory, you know, the memory unit at the hospital, you know, where we can sort of start doing all these interventions to help you. What we might be seeing is that women who are performing at the very, very top end cognitively, you know, doing a lot of linguistic gymnastics, they're like the intellectuals, or, you know, the high court judges or the lawyers or the people who rely very much on that kind of quick, sharp intellectual thinking or word-finding ability, they might be seeing, you know, like a tiny decrease in capacity. Again, it's not neurological. It's not because of some deficit. What we're probably seeing is this sort of shift in attention. There's competing demands. And that's the only time we're seeing this is in the third trimester of pregnancy. We're not seeing it in new mothers. If we're seeing it in new mothers, if women are saying they've got baby brain, we're not picking up cognitive test score decline. What we're seeing is a strong correlation with well-being. Hardly a surprise. If someone is stressed, if someone is not socially supported, if someone scores low on well-being, they're also very likely to score low on their perceived baby brain. Even if we say, here's your test scores, you're fine, it's still like, I've got baby brain. So, you know, we've got to start recrafting the stories that we're telling. During third trimester pregnancy, there's some interesting paradoxes, because sometimes if we do pick, you know, someone scoring, normally scores 19 out of 20 on a test, they're scoring 18 out of 20 some of the time. Those women are feeling that difference, but it's not classified as anything to worry about. And significant is a word I don't use because it's got statistical meanings in science. We try not to use significant, because significant means something different in science than it does outside science. It's either important or it's statistically valid. So we won't use significant. But there's a researcher who, you know, there's a group of researchers there in the US who became really kind of interested in these and sort of interrogating these ideas as well, going, well, look, we've got our newborn, our ewes, our new mum sheep ewes, and, you know, we've got our predatory animals and we've got our little nuts and seed gathering animals, and we're not like testing them on lists of shopping, or we're not getting the predators to see if they can smell the newborn baby lamb. We're not asking the ewes if their predation skills are getting better. So what we should be doing is coming up with cognitive testing that's kind of ecologically relevant to a species or to a person at a particular age or stage in life. And this is the thing, we've got these standardized tests which have been developed usually based on college-age white young males, 21-year-old boys. But they've been validated for, I'm being facetious, they've also been validated for Asian populations, etc. But these researchers have gone in and said, why don't we look to see if we can see improved memory for things that are ecologically relevant to a woman in her third trimester of pregnancy. And this study was done in New York. So we're like, what matters to a woman in the third trimester of her pregnancy in New York? So we're like, well, let's see if we can test her on things like different strollers or the price of strollers or different types of nappies or baby paraphernalia.
And nesting activities.
And that to like her memory for office equipment. Literally they used office equipment as the control. And what they found was that women in the third trimester of their pregnancy had a far superior memory for baby-related items than women who were not pregnant or for non-baby-related items. So like kind of seeing what's ecologically relevant to you at this point in time, where's your attention focused? Where your attention is focused, you've got far superior cognitive skills than remembering where the office stapler is, because really who cares where the office stapler is when you're about to give birth? But there's a lot of research kind of going in and trying to tease out what is going on in the space. And there is one research, I just want to like a shout out to her because she's awesome, Winnie Orchard, who was at Monash and is now at Yale, the Brain and Baby Lab in Yale, working with a woman, Helena Rutherford, who I write about in my book. And she's kind of got this really cool feminist take that from puberty, we don't do it as much to boys, we do it to girls. Whenever they're moody, we've got, what's your hormones? It's your menstrual cycle, your periods, it's PMS. And from puberty, even earlier, as soon as there's any sort of mood or emotional issue, we just hone in on the hormones as if they are the only voice in the crowd, and as if the presence or absence of a hormone is primarily there to determine negative mood. And when it comes to pregnancy and early motherhood, well, what are we doing? We're equating cognitive dysfunction and emotional instability with hormones. We're not looking at what the research is actually showing us. And women have just absorbed this narrative their whole lives. We all absorb various stories our whole lives, and then we're carrying that in. And then what's happening is we've been this kind of awesome, high-functioning career woman who's been able to do it all. And you have a baby and you expect to carry on being like superhuman and a super mom. What suits everyone else when there's a super mom? Because no one needs to help because she can do everything. And when she can't do everything and she starts to forget and flail, it's okay because she just blame her brain because it's neurological and there's nothing anyone else even needs to do. When what it probably is she just needs support and help because she doesn't need to remember where the office stapler is. She needs to be focusing in on looking after her baby. Someone else can go and find the bloody stapler and everyone else can gather around her and provide her the support she needs to learn to be a new mum and nurture the brain to develop the capabilities that it's been primed to do by pregnancy.
I mean, it speaks beautifully to, you know, the old saying that it takes a village, and there's a reason why it takes a village is because, as you say, the woman needs to be focused on nurturing and caring and attachment with the child.
We weren't, you know, we didn't evolve to parent alone.
No, but the other thing it speaks so beautifully to, which is what I love about Gabor's work, is compassion. And what I see in so many women, again, because it's almost like they blame themselves. You know, if it's my brain, then no one else can do anything about it.
And it suits society for the baby brain to be a thing, because who's going to, you can't do anything about neurological dysfunction. It's not neurological dysfunction. It's not. Why would Mother Nature want to make mothers stupid?
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Why would every other mammalian mother become smarter except for humans?
It doesn't make any sense. But I think, you know, one of the takeaways that, I hear from what you're saying is, you know, one, ask for the help you bloody need. You know,
no, like, I actually disagree.
Really?
You shouldn't have to ask.
Yeah, but unfortunately.
You shouldn't have to be asking.
We live in the real world, right? We shouldn't have to, but unfortunately we have to deal with what we've got.
A new mum shouldn't have an extra to-do on her to-do list.
No, I agree.
Ask for help. That shouldn't have to be there. Like you say, we live in the real world. I think that that's you know, that should be done by someone else. But.
And equally, like, just asking, and I say this to my clients all the time, because as women, I think we can be so good at beating ourselves up, you know, just acknowledging what it would look like to show yourself some compassion today, especially as a new mother, when you feel like you're being, pulled in
100%. If I knew the word matrescence, and almost this time 16 years ago, I was 9 months pregnant with my first son. If I knew then the word matrescence and understood the neurobiology, which we didn't know then because it hadn't been figured out, I would have given myself so much more grace and so much more kindness, because I was utterly, won't use the word blessed, but I was incredibly fortunate. My two babies were so straightforward and so easy. They ate heaps. They slept. They never caused me really any issues. They were so straightforward. They still are, as teenagers now, straightforward. There's different challenges with teenagers than there is with newborns. And I kept saying, they are easy. They're the easy part. It's me. Like, what has gone on with me? Like, the expectations I had of who I was going to be as a mother, and I carried in some quite set ideas, and actually I still have the same ideas about the kind of mother I wanted to be and the expectations I had of myself. But I just thought, because I had approached every other aspect of my life with ideas and expectations and kind of a plan, that it would roll out just as easy. And it's not as easy when you're a mother. But I would have given myself so much more grace and so much more kindness, and understood it was a process of becoming. And I didn't know it was a process of becoming. I thought it was just about the baby.
Oh, that feels like a
beautiful. And I thought I would still be me, and I wasn't. And that was weird. That was weird. That was totally weird.
That feels like a beautiful spot to kind of wrap things up in terms of, you know, honouring this idea that you need to be kinder to yourself and acknowledge that it's a process of becoming, and that you can't put structure and a plan around something that is filled with uncertainty and unpredictability.
Absolutely. And especially if you're an overachiever like I was and still am. I always said the bar is so high. My husband's like, I don't know how I jump over it, but I do. I set the bar so high for myself. And it's hard when you go into that and then suddenly, you know, you can't. And I always say I couldn't even empty the dishwasher without kind of crying and feeling a bit sorry for myself. And now it's, I'm so glad I went through what, well, every mother kind of does as you're going through that. And I didn't actually have any family support around. So I'm kind of proud I got through that. But I was just saying to someone yesterday, I was so determined. I didn't go back to work. I actually like kind of left the workplace. I wanted to give my children during their preschool years. I was determined that we would not be dropping off and picking up and checking in and checking out, and it would be easy and it would be relaxed, and we live by the beach, and so we would be at the beach in the parks, and it would just be very gentle and slow. And oh gosh, it was so hard at times. Those days were so long, but I was so determined to give them the same kind of childhood I had, which was like that with a mum around. I was privileged enough that my husband, you know, his job enabled me to do that. But also, you know, there's all of these stories now about all of the policies seem to be encouraging women back into the workplace, and it seems to be about your superannuation, and it's all about balancing the spreadsheet to ensure that financially we are cared for. And I completely understand that, and I was in a position where that didn't matter at the time. But what you can't account for on that was my absolute desire to give my children this time in their early infancy and early childhood, that for me, I was determined to do it like that. And I was determined that I would be the one that would do it. And I would kind of create this kind of little childhood for them that was almost idealized. And I'm so proud I did that, because now I've got teenagers and I kind of look back and I think, all those hard years. I'm really glad that, you know, I said I carried these some quite firm ideas and about, I don't care how anyone else, mothers, I couldn't care less what anyone else's decisions are or what anyone thought about mine. But I knew what I wanted to do, and I'm so glad I did that, and I'm so glad I sort of stuck to my guns, even when it was hard. Yeah, I'm really proud now looking back. And now it's a whole new ballgame because, you know, teenagers, you never stop parenting. You just have to up-level and up-level and up-level, and now it's all psychological gaming.
Oh, gosh. That's another
bottom that's, you know, going on, and I'm kind of glad that it was hard because that's how you learn, you know.
How can people find out about this amazing work that you've done and get access to these books?
Oh, well, in all good bookshops in Australia or on Amazon, there's an Audible version of Baby Brain, all the usual places. And then if you want to check out online, you can go to Dr. Sarah Mackay, mckay.com, and that's kind of a portal into all things that I talk about.
So I'm going to close this out with something I love to do, and I just want you to complete these statements, given we've been talking about mothering and motherhood and how it shapes.
And my rather firm ideas on it.
I love it. Complete the statement for me. Motherhood is.
I feel this real weird disconnection to that word motherhood.
Mothering.
Mothering. I don't know, continuing. I just kind of feel like it's this, I have this image in my mind that I'm trying to put into words that I can't, of this kind of thread that just continues. Like it's, you know, you're looking back, but also where we are now and then looking forward. It's just, it's kind of endless and continuing.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to be more succinct.
What does mothering feel like for you?
What does it feel like for me? It used to feel like such hard work. But I think for me it's about, I'm so proud of my watching these, and I remember this therapist saying to me, and I always remember this so clearly. She said, because I was like, you know, didn't know the word. Basically, if I hadn't known the word matrescence, I wouldn't have needed therapy. And she was Eastern European. She's probably Romanian. She was like, every little sock that you pick up from the floor and every crumb you wipe off the bench and, you know, and every tear you wipe away, she said, you're growing these little boys into young men. And she said, that's a process. And now I'm like, oh, my God, there's these, like, both of them are well over 6 foot tall now. So for me, it's like I say, I look back and I think, God, so hard, and I'm so proud because I grew. Just like she said, I grew these young men who are making their way out into the world. And I'm suffering, I say in my book, I'm suffering the fate of every mammalian mother, because that's kind of the point, is that they grow up and then they turn around and off they're going out into the world. And I think
I love that.
You're doing well, boys.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time today. I have no doubt our listeners are going to love this because it's completely different from anything we've ever had before. So thanks for sharing your wisdom, and we'll pop all of your links in show notes so that people can check out your work further.
You're so welcome.
Thanks for joining me on today's episode of the Hacking Happy podcast. Reviews are so important to empowering more beautiful humans just like you to lead wholehearted and flourishing lives. If you enjoyed your listen, I'd love if you could take a moment to leave a review and a rating on your preferred podcast listening platform. If there was something that resonated from this conversation, I invite you to take a screenshot and share your thoughts on social media. Tag me in so I can respond. If you've got a friend you feel needs to hear this episode, copy and paste the link and drop them a message now. It might be exactly what they need. Until next time, happiness looks good on you.